This is the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast from Taylist Media in association with KBB Birmingham 2020.
Welcome to the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast from Taylist Media. I'm Managing Editor Andy Davis. Now we're going all out bathrooms in today's episode, and in particular, we're looking at the wider trends that are influencing design in the commercial washroom sector. Now, I know, most of you are residential designers, don't moan at me, but I thought this was really worth looking into, as there's no doubt that commercial bathroom design, offices, hotels, you know, gyms, that kind of thing, is heavily influencing residential design. There's lots of reasons for that, I think, but one key one is that it's obviously a massive business for manufacturers, and it's therefore driving product development probably more than the residential sector is at the moment. Now, there's a really interesting report on this that's been commissioned by Ideal Standard, and it looks at how social life, work patterns, demographics, sustainability, technology are all influencing the way we look at bathrooms and how they fit into our lives. And in particular, it looks at how the needs, and therefore designs, of domestic and commercial bathrooms are merging together. In fact, the report says 70% of people want the same quality and experience from their workplace washrooms as from their bathrooms at home. So there's that. There's that merging that I'm talking about. So even if you're primarily a residential designer, you need to be very aware of the influence commercial bathrooms are having and are going to have on your work, I think. Ideal Standard launched this report called Creating Better Commercial Washrooms at a recent event at their new showroom in Clerkenwell here in London, and they gathered together a very illustrious panel, as you'll hear, of experts for the event, and I managed to sit down with them before they started. And in fact, if you listen very carefully, you can hear them setting up the event in the background. But before we get started, as usual, don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening on a desktop, get a podcast app on your phone and subscribe, as it's a much better way to keep up with us and to make sure you get the latest episodes as they go up. So I'll hand over to me and Clerkenwell now, let the panel introduce themselves, but I will put a link through to the full Creating Better Commercial Washrooms report in the description, as I really do recommend reading it, and you'll see why after you've heard everyone talking. So see you on the other side.
I'm Bibi Sellers, based here in London. I'm a design historian and author.
Hi, I'm Sisung Thomas. I'm an architect and designer based in London as well. I've been working in the industry for over 25 years here.
Hi, I'm Robin Levine. I'm a product designer. I've been working with Ideal Standard for over 30 years, maybe even 35. So a long relationship.
Hello, I'm Saul Golden. I am an architect for about over 20 years, and I'm currently a lecturer based in Belfast. I look at the Ulster University School of Architecture.
Okay, so we're here to talk about this report that you've written, Saul, into sort of commercial washrooms. But what's interesting about this report, I think, is the trends aren't, they are societal trends, ecological trends. They are trends that are affecting all kinds of design, not just commercial washrooms. That's kind of what makes it so interesting. But talk us through the report, what it's all about, and how you've got involved with it.
The report actually was a conversation, let's say, between Ideal Standard and myself is how it evolved. And I think there's always been an intention that we went beyond just marketing statistics and product testing to look at an evidence-based approach to better washrooms. And commercial washrooms was the focus of this report. And the report tries to set out a range of issues that really came from the survey feedback from both end users across Europe, from Italy, France, the UK, and Germany, as well as professional designers, architects, and specifiers. And it was really their response to questions that I developed based with Ideal Standard based on a review of existing research that's out there, but also looking, as you say, across many factors, sustainability, technology, social media, issues that affect gender and inclusivity and diversity. And all of those have informed ways that we might ask what is always, by the nature of this sort of report, a limited set of questions. But it both highlights areas that you say which were expected, some unexpected, and also areas which clearly require us to find future research to uncover the areas beyond just the data itself.
I mean, there's some really interesting stuff in here. So I think it's worth asking the designers in the room, how useful are these kind of overarching reports to how you literally physically sit down and design things? How sort of much do you soak up this kind of information on a practical day-to-day basis?
Well, as an architect and designer, I find this report quite interesting and very informative. It's obviously evidence-based approach, and I think as a designer it can be as informative as a POE, that's post-occupancy evaluation. But it's also good to know what our peers, other architects and designers, are thinking the same things.
Do you soak this stuff up subliminally when you're starting a project, or do you physically, would you sit and have a sort of mental checklist for yourself to go, okay, I need to do a bit more of that, I need to consider this?
It will be a mental checklist, yeah. Because as a designer, an architect, there's so many design parameters that we have to design with. And these cover things like statutory, regulatory requirements, industry standards, accessibility, all those things we have to take into account.
And what about you, Robin? Because you've obviously been designing products that have been going into people's homes and commercial projects for a long time. You're a veteran. Can I politely say it that way?
That's fine. I'll live with that. So a legend would be good.
That's good. A guru and a legend. How much do you take notice of these kind of trend-style reports that come out? Are you taking your own experience and kind of melting it all together, or are you thinking, okay, we've got to throw that out and start again? How do you?
So generally speaking, I don't take much notice, but actually with this one I've taken a bit more notice. I'm not trying to butter you up there, Saul, but there's always some revelations that come out of these pieces of work. I was fascinated with this idea of the three C's, comfort, cleanliness and convenience, which is actually what the end users are more interested in.
Yes.
So that's where this becomes fascinating, because designers are all talking about sustainability and it's top of their list, but for the end users it's something else. For a designer, it's really, really interesting to find out those kind of things.
Let's get into some of the details, shall we? Because you split this report into several trend areas. So we'll try and get through as many of them as we can in the next 20 minutes or so. But feel free to mix and match between them, because they all sort of overlap it, obviously, in many ways. Probably go back to you, Saul. What are the headline things that you found here about how society is affecting that design?
Well, again, there's a number of strands in there. The main one that came through was the way that urbanizing society is bringing people out of the homes more often, bringing more diverse people together for longer periods of time, and the stress of kind of working away from home, the long hours, travel, and all of those have an impact on people. There's also an expectation that there's a bit more equality across society, that everyone has an opportunity, and it doesn't matter depending on age or size, mobility, ability, genders, culture, that workplaces have to kind of cater for these things as well. A word that, again, isn't from myself, but has entered our lexicon, is the blurring of business and leisure, so-called bleisure activities.
Oh, what a dreadful word.
I think it's a wonderful word.
Really? It's bleisure?
Yes.
It's a bit of a bingo word, yeah. But it is something that, the idea that for a younger generation, which needs to be represented more in these sort of surveys, the idea of how you work and where you work is more of a, there's a hospitality, there's leisure, everything is kind of mixed up in making
you. I think that's very largely due to the mobile phone, the mobile working anytime, anywhere culture. We all do it. We'll be at home with our families having dinner, but we're still checking the phone for work emails.
Yeah.
So that sort of blurring of leisure and work, and I'm sure Libby agreed, me time.
Well, actually, yeah. I want to pick up on the societal change
that
Saul talks about. You know, the commercial washroom, like any kind of public infrastructure, seating, lighting, signage, is vital to how we move through the city, through the space, through our environment.
Mm.
And I'm delighted then that papers such as this are addressing the need for commercial washrooms to keep up with the mobile communities in which we lead, to enable us to have that mobile lifestyle. We need facilities available to us.
Yep.
And toilets, washrooms, however we choose to describe them, are indispensable to that movement.
It's a human right to have a decent washroom, in fact. But this idea of the me time, information overload and modern day life stresses, and the idea that we all need to compress our time. So we're literally multitasking. You know, we might pop into the loo and make a phone call as well at the same time afterwards. That's what's been happening.
Or Angry Birds, in my case.
It'd be interesting to hear from Libby, because one thing the report does pick up is that the commercial spaces, I mean, there are innovative companies at the top end of their game who are kind of leading the way. But by and large, especially in Europe, where you have a large existing infrastructure and existing buildings, and the time between turnover of fit out can be quite extended, you know, in terms of investment. So commercial washrooms aren't as much up to speed perhaps as retail or education sectors in addressing, I think, diversity in some ways, and maybe that's further research.
I find it very difficult to sometimes address this gender issue because I sit on both sides in the sense that I'm very aware that there's actually a lack of infrastructure for women in commercial and public spaces. Yeah, yeah. But in the same time, I think we also need to address a growing demographic, which admittedly is small at the moment. But certainly, if we're thinking about future planning and future progress, we need to be much more sensitive and sympathetic to a conversation that includes non-binary. Not necessarily gender neutral, but non-binary, those that choose not to be identified as any.
Even if you are, you know, I've known cases where we've gone, taken my daughter for swimming on a weekend and met another father with their daughters, and he's having to take his two daughters into a male changing room in order to get them changed, and that's quite embarrassing for him.
And this is one of the things I think comes out of this report, is that there is a blurring between expectations for what you have in your house, what you have in your home, and what you expect in your workplace or in your leisure environment. There's no such thing as all bathrooms at home are gender neutral, aren't they? Because you don't have a boys and a girls at home. So why would you expect it elsewhere? The idea that facilities need to mirror the way you move in and out of your work life, your home life. Yeah.
But even in the home, my wife has often said to me, sometimes when I buy the towels, there's an unconscious bias, perhaps, that my towels seem a bit more
masculine
perhaps than ships. So, and she's an architect as well, my wife. So we often have these conversations about those spaces. But I think it has to go more beyond sort of just changing a label. You know, I've been in places where, because of the furore of non-binary and gender, people have, in some instances, just put a sign on the door saying, this space is now for everyone, without addressing the design. So you have open urinals and a few cubicles, which means nobody is comfortable.
Yeah, it's a zero-sum game, because giving rights to some people, you're
taking away
them
rights
from somebody else.
I think there's a
signage isn't the solution.
No. There's a massive growth of unisex toilets where, you know, it's any sex, you can go in, and there's a basin as well as the actual toilet facility itself, and that's a growing trend. But this idea that domestic bathrooms are having an influence on commercial bathrooms, I just want to talk about the trends for that as a designer, where it's come from. It's actually come from these leading lights, benchmark campuses, workplaces from places like Google, Apple, Facebook. What the CEOs there are looking at is attracting the best talent and keeping there as much as possible to work. They're making their offices more home-like, you know, more residential-like. They'll put couches, pool tables and all sorts of things. And so obviously the natural trend is that the washrooms in these workplaces are going to reflect that in terms of a more homely environmental bathroom. But in terms of retail design, you've got the likes of Westfield, and they're always talking about the experiential destination, and you can't have your washroom let that down.
I'm looking forward to the washroom with the pool table in.
Well, you know what? It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, because there's so much construction work happening around big urban conurbations, there's so much building work happening all the time, that it's actually the commercial projects that are driving the research and development of products and product design. And because that's the case, there's so many logistical hoops that designers have to jump through, that ends up filtering down into the residential market as well, because that's where all the R&D money is going. So things like sustainability, which we'll touch on in a minute, are so important in commercial spaces because you have to tick that box on the
and social media has been, which we can touch on probably later as well.
I've got huge hotels and places like that. Well, look,
can I just add an anecdote? I think it's you were mentioning CEOs and COOs of
major companies. Yeah,
particularly Sheryl Sandberg, who was Facebook. And when she was pregnant and working for the firm, it was the first time she realised that the lack of parking facilities for people with limited mobility were not available in her company. They had a disabled parking bay, but that was only for people who had physical disabilities. As a pregnant woman, she didn't wish to be described as having
disability.
But she had to park at the back and walk, you know, quite a long way. And it was only through her experience that she then changed the legislation for parking. And I think experience is a large part of what informs
Absolutely.
Change in our environment.
Because now major supermarkets and major retail destinations have mother and baby parking spaces. So that must obviously have come from that. It's interesting.
Just a quick one, Andrew, before we move on. I'm going to pick you up on something.
Oh.
So you decided that within the domestic bathroom, there is no split between genders. Mm. But actually, on many bathrooms on continental Europe, there is. Mm. And we have domestic urinals.
Yes, true.
So, you know, the ladies aren't going to manage to pee in a urinal. It's very fascinating and could come here, although the water regs, I think, make it difficult to plumb them in. But it's wrong to define things the way they
just
always have been because it denies the possibility of change.
Yeah. One of the things that's always brilliant about these kind of academic reports is the language that comes out of them, right? So could you please explain to me, Saul, what the backstage microspace is?
I need to know that too.
Absolutely. It's not as academic as it sounds, but though it does come, it actually comes from a sociologist in the late 1950s, actually.
Right.
So it's about the kind of the modern change in lifestyle, which has been happening not just recently; it's been happening for decades, you know, since the post-war, business, people moving out of their homes, and modern life has just become so frenetic in many ways that the idea of the backstage is. It's almost a private kind of a space where you compose yourself or you motivate yourself or you just allow yourself a bit of calm before entering the business of life. You know, it could be a motivational speech to yourself before you go into a meeting like this, or it could be just a space to check your appearance. Now, because standards generally in everyday life have been increasing over the last sort of 20 to 25 years, in the workplace especially, standards have increased. So the washroom has just become one of those spaces, which it's not part of the front. It's not the front stage, to use that term. It's not the part of your main working time, but it is that space you go backstage. You know, the green room, let's call it, where you go back, you prepare yourself, or you make a call, you remove yourself, and then you come back in. You could be refreshed. You could, you know, check your hair, your makeup, things like that.
Let's hope no one's sitting outside desperate to go.
It's a microspace. We call it the backstage microspace, because
and architect, I could tell some anecdotal stories, conversations we've had with clients in the past about these backstage places. The modern workspace can be daunting. It's largely open plan. There are no privacy spaces. And as you know, if you're working professional, sometimes you do need to be private and go off and make private phone calls or have a private word with a colleague and things like that. And this is happening outside of the open plan offices. It's happening in the stairwells. It's happening in the washrooms. And we've even had one client say to us, they've actually put in privacy cubicles in the open plan offices, and it's not attracting any usage at all. All we can assume is because it's too conspicuous.
Yeah.
If you want to make
the clear sight,
exactly. Whereas if you're visiting the toilet, it's a legitimate use of your time.
Well, I think this sort of extends into our next area, really, isn't it? Which is about wellness. It's about creating spaces that overlap with people's hobbies, leisure life.
Yes.
So it's about not just creating a bathroom where you can go to the toilets, but it's also about where you can take a shower, you can go to the gym.
It's beyond just the washroom. It extends to shower rooms for biking to work and things like that. I mean, we talk about all the world's a stage. Everyone's got their selfie or Instagram kind of image versus their real self. The washroom, the shower room, those spaces are just really part of that.
But
just
they're also social spaces. Are we talking about multifunctional spaces?
Yes.
They're also social spaces, and it's important actually designers do acknowledge that that washrooms are social spaces.
Well, there needs to be a balance, doesn't there, between social and private.
Is there a stage where how you would have your bathroom at home is completely different because you have facilities at work? In other words, you might have all your showers at work because if you're going to the gym or you're cycling, and therefore your bathroom at home takes on a different function again.
What about the weekends?
But if you still go to the gym, or you know, this is what I mean by the commercial washroom. It's not just your work; it's also your gym, your spa.
I have three teenagers. I often will cycle into work and use the shower, then fight with everyone there.
The traditional process of getting up in the morning and using the bathroom, which is what a lot of people traditionally would design their bathroom around, is completely what this report highlights is that is completely changing.
Yeah,
and whether that's different generations, whether that's what you choose to do when you get to work or when you get back. So is there an argument that your bathroom at home might look different in 10 years' time because of what they're using bathrooms for elsewhere?
I think it could well do. I mean, it's an evolution, isn't it? Yeah. And fortunately, it's heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. We're becoming more civilised.
Yes.
I mean, I have a memory of being in Stoke-on-Trent, ceramics industry, as a young designer, and being really horrified that the factory toilets had no door on to avoid the possibility of somebody reading the paper. Okay, so we've made progress, right? Things are moving in the right direction. Yeah. Something that really fascinates me, and I don't know where it's going to take my thinking, but what about designing a toilet only for women? Because the toilet sitting in that cubicle is designed for either men or women to use. That's a fascinating one. This could be the beginning of a project.
If I'm speaking on behalf of clients, I think that will be difficult for them because we're going back to this gender fluidity neutral. You don't want to actually have such specific facility for a single group of people because that makes it unusable for another group of people.
Yeah, but so, it is a single group of people that are more than half the population.
Yes.
So I think it is
worth thinking about. You know, do ladies want a hinge seat? Do you want a hinge seat on your toilet that men have peed all over and you have to pick it up and put it back down? Do you want that?
Yeah, sorry about that.
So, you know, is a toilet for women doesn't have a hinge seat? Your report's bringing out these thoughts in me.
From a domestic point of view, actually it's going the other way. I mean, having just finished a small extension design, and where I'm also involved in research on sort of lifelong living, looking at how you can extend people's ability to live in their communities. So
you mean lifetime homes and lifetime homes.
And I know even in a small extension we were trying to look at making something ambulant disabled or eventually easily adaptable to make something useful for a wheelchair, future-proofing and things like that. So I think there is that blurring again of the two.
Well, that does lead us on to one of these other areas of the report here very nicely. It highlights there is quite a big gap between what designers think people want or think is important, and what the users actually look for when they come into that. So give us some examples, Sean, of what some of these big differences are.
Well, again, I don't think that I would characterise them as big differences. That first thing I would say. There are some differences which the report, you know, and the survey comes back, where looking at noise control or the performance of flushing was maybe seen as less important from an end user point of view in this response than some of the designers, whereas everyone agreed on cleanliness and hygiene. Sustainability might be one where it appears that there's a difference, but I think, again, it comes back to this notion of the three C's. So there is a real impetus to look at sustainability and to make everything kind of around that choice, whereas end users are really concerned with, yes, sustainability, but as long as it doesn't compromise my comfort and convenience at the same time. And I think that's really just both conversations and education at the same time, but it's also being quite clear to make people aware of where those differences kind of agree. And I think maybe Robin can talk about this from a designer point of view, and yourself. Sometimes designers have to make difficult choices to slightly change the way we have been working, whether it is the type of spaces or the type of fixtures and things like that.
If I could just, from a designer's architect's point of view, the major thing, not saying the report is not useful, it's terribly useful, is that it's missing the client's perspective. And when we say the client, we mean property developers, corporate developers.
The person paying the bill.
Paying the bill, exactly. Yeah, yes. They are not necessarily the end user. In fact, the end user proportion of clients are very small. So we talk to clients and we get briefed by clients all the time. So they don't necessarily reflect the end user's requirements, but they do reflect the client's requirements.
But that's a trickier discussion as well, because you could ask the same question: do designers and their clients actually agree? You know, there's ethics. There's how much do you compromise yourself in the end?
Yeah, I mean,
you might not agree, but
so for example, clients' concerns are flushability of the toilets when we specify very low water fittings, because again, the major issue that you're saying designers care more about sustainability than users do. That's because one of the primers is that legislation and regulation are forcing designers to look at the sustainability side. So it's high on designers' agenda, more so than the users. For users, I could totally understand it's about comfort, hygiene. But designers, we have all these other primers that we have to comply with.
And you know, it makes life really tough for the product designers. I mean, when I started as a young designer, we flushed the loo with 13 litres. often from a tank high up on the wall. When you pulled the chain, it went with a massive deluge. And it's gone 9, 7, 6, 5, 2, 4, 2. You know what? The interesting thing is, though, the toilet as an item has not got more efficient through that process. Yes. It's been harder and harder and harder to make the damn things work. And it's it really is a challenge.
Well, we're forced to, you know, through Bream and Lead and various other sort of primers, to go for low water fittings. So very often we'll specify them, have them installed, and the clients a few months later after the building's open will come back and say, well, we've had to take them all out and put higher water.
Well, again, if an end user is flushing the toilet four times and won't leave the bathroom because something remains in their
embarrassing thing.
I can't leave the toilet.
My worry is that focusing so much on water might be to the detriment of other things could that be. Might matter too. Mm-hmm. And it's such an obvious thing that water saving is what the bathroom should be about. But what about energy?
Yes.
You know, and in the domestic environment, thermostatic valves that control the temperature of the water is a brilliant idea to save energy.
Yeah.
How many people fill their bathtubs through a thermostat?
Well, it's the age-old argument about bathrooms, isn't it? Compared to, say, kitchens, like a washing machine, which uses a fixed amount of water.
Yeah.
You can use half as much water in the shower by staying in there half the amount of time. It's a personal choice.
I kind of disagree. I'm a bath person, I don't know about you, but if you have shallow baths, it's more effective than having a long shower.
So, well, we could each one of these topics we could do an entire hour on, couldn't we?
But
let's talk a little bit about technology, because you've already touched on it a bit, Saul. Is how technology that people have in their hands is driving how bathrooms are designed.
Sure.
I mean, I particularly see this in hotels, where a lot of designers are now getting briefs in hotels that the bathrooms have to be very Instagrammable, you know, because it is part of how they, the promotion of that hotel. The idea of having a pod bathroom that is repeated endlessly is kind of disappearing a little bit because...
Yeah, the individuality is coming back.
But that crosses technology and social media, I suppose. But from a technology point of view, you have those things that can we come back to. Everything overlaps, but the things which we see, which readily kind of notice, whether it's a infrared sensor that's on a wall, or it's a button that we have to press, or there's clearly a way that we can obviously operate a hand dryer or taps or the toilet. There's also the unseen technology, things that monitor and feed back to the company itself that allow you to actually record, well, how much is being used, how much water or energy is actually being used versus what's on the label. I think what's interesting in the developments here throughout Ideal Standard, there are sensors which tell you when parts aren't working, and when they need to be replaced as well. So there's a whole kind of efficiency that might look at how you recycle, how you adapt, and connects to the Internet of Things, which is everywhere. And that comes back to your phone. So you do have situations where, depending on the type of space you're in, and it happens in workplaces, where the car that you carry as an employee actually can set sensors and lighting and temperature and things ahead of time. And, that might be something which extends maybe not to the shared bathroom, but there are ways that which it could be that when you're in a particular place, it knows to lower the lighting in a cubicle or something else.
I think from a designer's point of view, the idea that you can monitor usage will be terribly important for clients. And I keep stressing that because clients are the ones who pay and have the project, built. They're constantly looking for ways to reduce space, non-lettable space usage. And I'm afraid toilets are non-lettable spaces. These are backroom spaces. Very important, but they don't generate rent. And I can see in the future years that as we know more and more about the usage patterns and efficiency, clients may be able to reduce their numbers of toilets and washrooms that they need to provide, because actually they can even out the peaks and troughs of usage.
That's why reports like this are always great, because they always contain little nuggets which are brilliant. So, for example, you do a little study on how people flush the toilet.
Yes.
And how many, what percentage of people use their foot, what percentage of people use their elbow. The back of the hand, which is, what's the point of that? I don't know. You might as well use the front. If we can sort of sum it all up, unfortunately, which we kind of have to do because of time here.
Of course.
If there's an overriding theme to all this, it's about understanding more how the individual uses their spaces when they are private or alone, and how they expect to see that now reflected in
their outside world, not just their home world.
Well, one of my, and we'll conclude with this because it's the bit that jumped out of this report more than anything else, is what people use the shower for at work. It's such a small thing, but it's the, because this is the one thing I told everyone about. Is some people use it after they've used the cycle to work. Mm-hmm. Some people use it when they've been to the gym. Some people use it before they're going on a night out. But it's something like 9% of people use it after sleeping. It's the idea that people are sleeping at work and then having a shower. Sure. Please talk me through that.
Well, I can only talk from an architectural experience, but I'm sure it happens on a long legal case, or you've got a presentation, marketing, you're doing advertising. Yeah. Sometimes, in a creative sense, in a creative practice, the hours, you might be working all nighter to get something done. You have a presentation in the morning, or you have a competition that's due.
Andrew's really disappointed because he wanted it to be an after lunch power nap.
Yeah, really.
Well, those are famous. But in themselves, you could be working through the night or long hours, or you could come in really early in the morning, and it's an opportunity to refresh yourself.
Okay, I'll let that off then. I just thought it was somebody nodding off their desk.
Yeah. And on those habits in the washroom, I think you missed one, which is the phenomenon called tailgating.
So people
will actually wait for someone else to leave the washroom so that they can sneak out without having to touch the door. But I have a hobby horse about this because I think the survival of human beings rather depends on our ability to deal with bacteria.
Yes.
And if we insulate ourselves completely, we're in for big trouble when one comes along and knocks us all right out because we never experienced it.
There is that brilliant Alan Partridge sketch of him showing how he gets himself in and out of a train facility.
Unfortunately, I think time's probably beaten us.
Thank you.
I will conclude by saying I saw a sign once in a commercial washroom, should we call it, that said simply, "We aim to please, so you aim to please." Which, I think, if that doesn't sum up the cleanliness argument, I don't know what does. So, look, thank you very much for all your time today. I do appreciate we're at an event and you've got to go out and have this conversation all over again. So thank you so much for your time. So there we go. Thank you very much to Saul Golden, Libby Sellers, Seesung Thomas, and, of course, Robin Levine. Now, I appreciate there's an awful lot to unpack in all that. A five-way discussion is a little bit of a free-for-all. So I really do recommend reading the Ideal Standard report, and you should be able to find the link to that in the podcast description. I'll also put the bios of our panel on there too, so you can find out a little more about them. And a huge thank you actually to Ideal Standard for hosting us and setting it all up. That's very much appreciated. And I also actually recommend a trip to their fantastic new Clark & Mills showroom if you're down that way. It really does look very smart. Thanks for listening. As always, don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you got this podcast from, and feel free to rate and review as it really helps other people find us. See you next week.
The Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at KBB Birmingham 2020, the biggest kitchen and bathroom exhibition in the UK. It's on from March the 1st to March the 4th, 2020, and we'll be there recording live episodes for this very podcast every afternoon. You can register for your place at kbb.co.uk. See you there.